program you are about to hear, Bob Slacktime Funhouse, is parody, satire, and comedy. Any reference to Bob, the Church of the Subgenius, religion, politics, or any other touchy subjects is intended only as humor and should cast no reflection on the high standards of WREK Atlanta, its staff, or that of Georgia Tech.
Welcome, seekers, to a very special episode of Bob's Slacktime Funhouse. I'm your rapidly rotating little prayer partner, the Reverend Susie the Floozy. And I know I overuse that special episode shtick a lot, but oh, seekers, you have no idea just how special tonight's episode is going to be. Because we have a very special guest here, seekers. The subgenius Saint Betty Page. Oh, for those few of you who don't know who Betty Page is, Fie upon you! You may not be able to remember right now, but oh, you've seen that distinctive hairstyle of hers in innumerable incarnations, from the raven-haired Veronica Lodge in Archie Comics to the tightly manicured black bangs on every other goth chick. Oh, I could say that she was a famous pinup model of the 50s, but that doesn't even begin to cover her influence. Betty Page is a ubiquitous icon. Betty Page was your grandfather's bottom bureau drawer secret crush, your dad's first rush of testosterone, and if you have any sense of style, she's your idea of the perfect woman. She's the bongo-beaten fever dream of every hipster, the curvy Lilith urging you into the dark side of fun with a drop-dead gorgeous figure and a merry blue-eyed twinkle. She's a dichotomous mix of sweetness and sin. And even in her wildest bondage photos, she radiated an odd sort of divine purity. And that girl next door gone wow quality made her a raging success. But the fact that she was a guilty pleasure kept her almost totally off the radar of the mainstream cultural zeitgeist. It was this weird state of simultaneous veneration and absolute denial that eventually made it possible for her to utterly disappear and hide away in plain sight. Oh, yes, sir. Betty Page is as close as our culture has come to producing a female Elvis, and she didn't even rock and roll. Hell, she made us do it just by looking at her. Oh, I'm going to drop a little background on Betty so that what you are about to hear will make sense to you. I want to do this right, seekers, because this may be one of my most momentous shows ever, and I want what unfolds here tonight to absolutely ring with the impact that it so richly merits, because seekers, tonight, you are going to hear the true story of Betty Page, recorded on tape out of the mouth of the lady herself. Do I have your attention now? I thought so. All right. First, here's the framework so you know what the lady's talking about. Here are the facts. At least the facts as they were known, more or less, in the uncertain days when Betty was AWOL. She was born in Tennessee, a child of the Depression who migrated to New York City after the war. She did secretarial work until one fateful day when she went to Jones Beach and was discovered by Jerry Tibbs. Tibbs was already noteworthy before he discovered the girl who'd become the queen of the cheesecake pinup. He was one of the few black photographers working in the late 40s. He made the acquaintance of the pretty girl he saw on the beach and respectfully asked if he could take some pictures of her. And this little country girl just bloomed before his lens. Betty Page, for that was her real name, with an I-E on the end of the Betty. Betty didn't have her trademark bangs then, but, oh, she had the sparkle all right. It was Jerry Tibbs who groomed her for the camera. It was Jerry Tibbs who taught her the secret ways of knockout modeling. And it was Jerry Tibbs who suggested she cut her hair. And damn, how those close-cut black bangs frame those strangely warm, ice-blue eyes. For some reason, it was an almost electric effect. In fact, today, the concept of Betty Page can be evoked by a simple black pictograph of her hairdo. Her modeling career soon took off. She did a lot of work for New York area camera clubs, groups of amateur photographers who'd pool their money to hire a couple of models for the day. The group would usually go to some outdoor locale that was free of citizens and free of cops, and there they'd set up. And a whole battery of photographers would take simultaneous shots of the models as they cavorted nude in verdant settings. Buck Henry, yes, that Buck Henry, was a member of one of these camera clubs, and boy, does he ever fondly remember Betty. Oh, untold hundreds upon hundreds of pictures of her were taken at these junkets, and in every single one of them, she shone. She knew just what to do to make the best possible image from any angle. She was gifted with a natural, easygoing grace that was honest and bouncingly cheerful. Oh, Betty began to appear in magazines published by the Robert Harrison Empire. Cheesy rags with titles like Flirt and Wink and my personal favorite, Titter. She appeared in silly stage fumettis and the feel of a down-at-the-heels burlesque show routine. But Betty made the goofiest setup funny and surprisingly sexy, even if her co-star was a guy in a moth-eaten gorilla costume. Betty was becoming a popular commodity, so popular, in fact, that she even appeared in the fourth issue of Playboy, wearing only a Santa hat and holding a strategically placed Christmas ornament. And then she fell in with the Irving Claw Studios. Claw, along with his sister Paula, ran Movie Star News, an outlet for publicity photographs of Hollywood stars. The Claws also did a thriving side business in cheesecake pics, particularly involving custom-ordered bondage and domination themes, dark concepts that were especially verboten in the tight sphinctered McCarthy years. It doesn't matter that now Betty's most furtively hidden images are emblazoned on T-shirts for sale at Hot Topics. To the vanilla sensibilities of the Ward and June Cleavers of conservative white bread America, this was a basis pornography. In the 50s, juvenile delinquency was obsessing the American public. Oh, they couldn't have caused a scourge of scofflaws and curfew breakers. They were good Christian parents. So they set about grasping about for a scapegoat. And in this climate of outraged moral hysteria, comic books were dragged to the stake. And then smut. Tennessee Senator Estes Kefauver helmed the Senate subcommittee looking into this vile mess, and fellow Tennessean Betty was dragged to the hearings to testify. This worked its way into the folklore. When Kefauver asked her,
"Miss Page, what do you think of the unusual outfits you wear for these pictures?"
Betty is reported to have replied,
"Why, Senator, honey, I think they're cute."
Right on! "Young lady, another outburst like that and I shall hold you in contempt."
Order. Oh, but as a result of this outcry, Irving Claw was pilloried and hounded into obscurity by the government and society in general. Betty moved to Florida, where she did work with fellow pinup model turned photographer Bunny Yeager. Remember those Jungle Girl pics with the cheetahs? Yeah! Oh, but not long after that was where the trail went suddenly cold. After having appeared all over, Betty was suddenly nowhere to be found. Her old associates like Bunny and Paula drew blanks when they tried to find her. Betty Page, it seems, had just fallen off of the map, leaving nothing behind but rumors and wistful memories and thousands upon thousands of glossy photographs. In the 1980s, there was a resurgence of interest in Betty. Dave Stevens led the charge when he put her into his comic series, The Rocketeer. That striking image of hers opened up a floodgate of renewed Betty Page fervor, this time tinged with a haunting air of mystery. Whatever had happened to her? Where was she now? A magazine titled The Betty Pages, Betty with a Y because nobody at the time knew the real spelling, Well, that came soon after. It was published by Greg Theakston, and that's where I come in. I was a writer on the last few issues of the Betty Pages. Just doing cheesy entry-level stuff like book reviews then. But fortuitously, it brought me close to ground zero at a crucial time. Theakston was in on the rediscovery of Betty in the mid-90s. He had tirelessly dogged her trail for years, cataloging his finds as he published each issue of the Betty Pages. Oh, I got to do the dirty work, like transcribing audio cassettes of his interviews, like the one he did with Betty's country boy ex-husband Billy, an alcoholic hothead who marked each major turn of his life with a brutal fistfight. Oh, even though it was often boring work, I did love that job. Oh, but the real perk came when I was delivered a 2-hour audio cassette to transcribe of Greg Theakston's interviews with Betty Page herself, which is what you're about to hear tonight. For 12 long years,
more like 16,
I have kept this tape close to my heart. But recent news has made it so important that I finally break down and share this fascinating audio document with you, Seekers. Oh, you know, the very day sweet Forry Ackerman finally slipped away from us, Betty Page had a heart attack. And she's gone now. We've lost one of our most wonderful icons, and I want you to know exactly what we gave up. I want to strip away the veils of legend and innuendo and to breathe pulsing, vibrant life into the celebrated flesh of Betty Page. Oh, I had my work cut out for me with this one, Seekers. Sometimes it may be obvious that I've jacked up the sound level so that you can hear Betty, but hey, Seekers, I didn't want you to miss a word of this. And I feel proprietary enough about this to want to mark my territory, so I'm going to drop in some jazzy background textures behind her. Hey, can you blame me? After all, I've been sitting on this cassette since 1996, Seekers. Yes, 12 long years.
16, you bimbo.
And back when it was done, Betty was in her early 70s. Hell, even I was younger. I want you to listen as a lady tells you, with her own voice, about her incredibly strange and unwittingly influential life, and her apparent pivotal contact with Dobbs himself. And do keep in mind, Seekers, this is only the first half of a 2-part episode. We begin with the interview already in progress. My erstwhile boss, Greg Theakston of the Betty Pages, is interviewing Betty Page, beginning with him copying the credit for me transcribing the tapes.
I've transcribed that, and I'm going to send it to you for your approval. If there's anything you don't like about it, put a big red X over it. In fact, everything that I write about you from here on in, I'll be sending you copies of to look at before it goes out. Oh, and by the way, Jim wants to do some kind of a follow-up piece for Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous to indicate that, you know, you're finally being represented and getting a piece of the profits from the whole Betty Mania. And just a follow-up to let everybody know you're doing well. And I hope you are.
Yes.
Oh, that's good. Do you remember, were you a very good artist yourself? Did you draw at all?
When I was in my teens, I used to draw girls, and we would have beauty contests, my sisters and I. Guessing the, deciding who had the prettiest eyes, the prettiest mouth, prettiest costume. We would just play games with it. And I used to draw horses a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very fond of horses.
Mm-hmm. Did you spend any time on the farm when you were younger?
When I was 9 years old, we lived on the farm about 30 miles from Nashville.
Uh-huh.
We had to walk 2.5 miles to school. And sometimes we would come home for lunch and we wouldn't go back. To
give it up.
The creek and yeah. It's time to come home.
Uh-oh, bad kids. What was your favorite drink when you were younger? Did you drink Coke or Pepsi? Or
root beer.
You liked root beer, huh? Mm-hmm. I always kind of wondered. I said, I bet Betty liked Pepsi. That was my guess.
Like
ours, yeah, I always stacked well on that stuff, huh? Yeah, those high school days are fascinating to me because, of course, the high school looks exactly like it did when you went there. Nothing has changed. I looked at the stage and I said, I could just see little Betty Page, you know, performing up there in whatever she was in.
I was salutatorian, so I had to give the opening speech.
I know.
And if I hadn't been able to have a long dress, I would have stuck out like a sore thumb.
No way to even get a shopkeeper to open up.
We couldn't get anybody to open up. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I was just mortified. So finally, I started knocking on doors, asking girls if they had an evening gown that I could wear to graduate in. And finally, I came to one girl who said yes, she had a white organdy gown that she thought would be suitable.
Uh-huh.
So she let me wear it.
Close call.
That was a terrible feeling, not knowing what I was going to wear to my own graduation.
No kidding.
It was just a very unhappy time.
Well, I guess it all worked out in the end, though, huh?
Yeah.
Do you think that all of that extra dramatic stuff in your senior year was your downfall, and that was why you didn't get valedictorian?
No, I don't know that I knew what it was all about.
Uh-huh.
He was the fellow who was valedictorian. His father was a teacher, and his mother was a teacher.
Uh-huh. I bet studying came easily to him, or naturally to him.
He just beat me out of one quarter.
Oh, it was so close. Must have been a heartbreak.
It was. Because I had wanted the scholarship to Vanderbilt, which he got.
But you did get the Daughters of the American Revolution Award.
Yes, I got the DAR.
Now, how was that awarded to you? What was your competition?
The teachers selected the one person who was to win the DAR medal.
Uh-huh.
My teacher selected me.
And that was the only place that you could use that award was Peabody?
Yes.
Would Peabody have been your choice if you had money to go somewhere else?
No, I would have gone to Vanderbilt.
Uh-huh. Your speech was called Looking Forward?
Yes, I think so.
I saw that in the...
How did you get that?
I looked that up in the yearbook when I went to Nashville. I've done my homework, Miss Page. Somebody said you were homecoming queen. Does that, you know...
I was never homecoming queen.
But you were involved, you know, extracurricular. You told me about the radio station and the mystery that you wrote.
Yes. The significance of an urn, I titled it.
The significance of an urn? What was the plot?
Gee, I knew you were going to ask that. I don't even remember.
But the title sticks back in your head, huh?
I remember having a secret room in the house, but that's about all I remember.
Yeah. Did you perform in there?
No.
Strictly a writer, huh? Did you ever consider being a reporter? You seem to have had a knack for that.
No, I never thought much about it. I enjoyed being co-editor of the Foghorn.
Now,
the Senior Echo.
Right. The when you guys took the Foghorn over, the format was changed. It looked like a completely newly designed paper from the year before to your year. And you guys got awards for the new look. Was that partially your doing? It must have been if you were co-editor.
Yes.
You really knocked the newspaper into shape. I could see the difference. They have them all bound. And I looked through their library of goodies, and I was very frustrated, too, that there were just no bylines. There was no way to tell what you had written. Do you have a conscious memory of working hard to get that newspaper up?
I would sometimes stay after school until 7 or 8 o'clock at night, working on the paper.
Did you ever march with the ROTC?
Yes, as ROTC sponsor, regimental sponsor of all three high schools, I had to march with them.
Mm-hmm. You had a uniform?
Yes.
Did you twirl a baton?
No.
Did you ever twirl a baton?
No.
Even on your off hours?
No.
Because that sounds like a mandatory thing for, a student in as high a profile as you seem to be at that school. In fact, Billy was telling me that, you know, your reputation exceeded the limits of Hume Frog and people at East knew who you were, too. You must have been a hot one, Betty Page, in your senior year.
I was very busy.
Yeah, you sound like you had a full schedule. And then on top of that, going to the movies all the time.
No, I didn't go much to the movies in those days. I didn't.
No time, huh? Oh, no money, huh? What about the debate club in high school? Seems to me you were in the debate club in high school in your senior year. What do you remember what you debated on?
One subject was, should the government control the railroads?
Uh-huh. Who won?
I don't remember.
I guess it wouldn't matter either. Somebody said you played the guitar. Is that true?
I played a little bit, but not much.
Uh-huh.
I don't even remember it now.
Uh-huh. What else did you... somebody said you played the piano, too. Is that true?
Yes, I studied a little bit when I was a child.
Uh-huh.
Down at the Bertha Finsterwald Social Center, where children could go and learn various things.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned arts and crafts. And I learned to play the piano. But I didn't have a piano at home, so I couldn't practice.
I see.
Except when I went down to the social center.
Uh-huh. Also, when you were in San Francisco during the war, where were you working? Somebody said you were working at a department store.
No, I worked for Enterprise Engine and Foundry Company.
Uh-huh.
As secretary to the sales manager.
Uh-huh.
Nice place to work.
Uh-huh. Did you do any modeling before you came to New York City? Did you ever model prior to coming and posing for Tibbs?
No.
That was the very first time you were photographed, huh?
Yes. That was Jerry Tibbs, who was a police officer.
Do you remember the first time you posed nude for a photographer? Was that,
I think it was for a camera club.
Yeah, probably. Maybe Cass Carr?
Probably was
Cass
Carr.
Was it, you remember, was, you know, were you nervous? Was it really a hard thing to do?
No.
Because, I mean, after all, you know, it's 1950 or 51?
1950, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you had you were pretty broad-minded about the arts.
Yes.
Did you like to shoot on those locations?
Oh, yeah. That was some of the fun part of the
line. Yeah, there was a shoot with you at Palisades Park with Johnny Wilson.
Yeah, I remember that.
Do you remember who shot that one? Was that Jack Bradley, perhaps?
I don't
remember. I noticed you guys are wearing bikinis in a time that's almost before bikinis. It's 1952.
Yeah.
Where did you guys, where did those come from?
I think Mr. Harrison had those.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't belong to either one of us.
Mm-hmm. What do you remember about Harrison?
No, I don't remember much about him.
Yeah, I hear he had two sisters that worked at the place. His two sisters worked in the office.
I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm. And supposedly he used to photograph. He was the publisher and the editor and the photo editor and the paste-up guy, and he'd photograph the girls himself.
Gee, don't remember.
Some awful, some awful crazy shoots. You know, you with a guy in a gorilla outfit, or.
The main thing I remember about working for him is you had to be taped. Your breasts had to be taped. He had to have cleavage, whether you had any or not.
Oh, I see.
He would tape our breasts.
Mm-hmm.
It made a line down the middle.
Right.
He did that with all the girls, whether you were busty or not.
Very interesting. That's some of your earliest material at the Harrison. An awful lot of burlesque-style skits. And, you know, I think you excelled at those because you were, you know, interested in being an actress, too.
Well, I was interested in being an actress, but I didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I waited too late in years before I started studying.
All right.
And I never even tried out for Broadway or off-Broadway.
Mm. Well, okay. Also, what about this Miss Press photographer?
No, it was at the Artist Ball.
Uh-huh.
I won a contest for the most interesting costume.
Uh-huh.
I had a little suggestion box right across the lower part.
Uh-huh.
Two telephone dials over my breast and some of those black net stockings up to the waist.
And that a big cardboard ear?
Yeah.
That part of the costume?
And I thought that was corny, but he wanted to have it on there. It was Harrison.
Uh-huh.
Harrison's magazine.
Did he sponsor that? Did he sponsor you going to that thing?
He sponsored me,
uh-huh.
And I won the contest.
Yeah, what a great...
And I got a nice set of Revere kitchenware.
Uh-huh. Just what every woman
pots
needs.
Pots and pans and everything.
Uh-huh. You didn't cook much, did you? You know, what was your week like? Did you shoot Camera Club every day?
Oh.
Or once a week, or...?
Probably about once a week that I would work for the Camera Club.
Somebody said that one time he ran out of film and you were, you know, buck naked. You ran over to your purse, got $5 out, and ran back to him and gave him the $5. Now you go buy some more film and then come back and shoot me some more. Which I thought that's the most generous thing I've ever heard a model do.
I never heard of that. I don't remember.
Yeah. Well, it's a cute story. It kind of helped me know you a little bit better, too, that you really liked what you were doing in the Camera Club. You know, you like being a model.
Yes, I liked posing for artists, too.
Every once in a while, a paperback cover will turn up and it'll look like you, or a record cover, or a piece of advertising. And you always just wonder, you know, is this just... Does it kind of look like Betty, or did Betty really pose for this? When you did your screen test, do you remember that at all? Must have been exciting.
It was.
And disappointing at the same time.
Yes, I was very disappointed in it. I wish they had left my makeup like I would ordinarily wear it.
Uh-huh.
And not try to make me up like Joan Crawford.
Yeah, I guess that was the look of the moment, huh?
Yes.
Unluckily for you. Now, that brings to mind the screen test for Hughes. You actually made a test for Hughes?
His right-hand man, I think his name was Jimmy, I believe.
Yeah.
I've forgotten really, though, what his name was.
Uh-huh.
He called me and said that Howard Hughes wanted to meet me.
Right.
And I told him that I wasn't interested in meeting Mr. Hughes. But he said that they would like to screen test my face on various angles. So that's what he did. Just close-ups of my face, but I didn't see the pictures or anything like that, and nothing ever came of it.
Mm-hmm. You didn't sign a contract or anything?
No.
Who did you, if you could have been any actress, you know, who did you admire most as an actress?
Well, my, I had so many of them, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know any particular.
You know, I would think like Betty Davis.
Betty Davis was one of my favorites.
Yeah. Maybe Katharine Hepburn. Or...
Yes.
What male stars did you like?
Oh, every one of them.
Yeah, Clark Gable and Humphrey Bogart.
I liked all of them.
Uh-huh. You're kind of hard to pin down on this one, huh? Well, that's okay. I mean, that says something, you know, too. I mean, that you really enjoyed. Was, you know, did you like musicals more than you liked drama, or did you have, no preference?
No preference. I liked them all.
Even the monster movies?
Even the horror movies.
Even Boris Karloff, huh? So, would you, you went to the movies more when you got to New York City?
Yes, I went all the time to New York City.
What else did you do? Did you ever go to nightclubs or, you know, what was your off hours like here?
Sometimes I would go to the movies on 42nd Street where they would show their good old movies.
Oh, yeah, stage shows.
I would go from about 8 o'clock in the evening until 4 in the morning.
Wow.
They would just cross the street from one movie house to another.
Life of a freelance model, huh?
Go to another movie.
Uh-huh.
And I would walk down the streets from 42nd Street up to West 46th Street where I lived.
Right.
I would walk all around in there. 4 o'clock in the morning.
It's very safe.
Never frightened or
anything.
Uh-huh. Nobody ever said a word to me.
Hmm.
I would be wearing jeans and a jacket and a bandana on my head.
I guess not. Incognito, huh? Mm-hmm. That was the way you dressed all the time, though.
Yeah, I used to wear jeans a lot.
Yeah. But you never had any trouble here, New York. Did you really carry a brick in your purse?
No.
Somebody told me you used to carry a brick and you would hit guys.
No, I don't know where they got that.
It's kind of a colorful story, though, don't you think? Dick Arbib said that, the first time he asked you out, you said, oh, no, I can't go out. I don't have a dress. And he took you out and bought you a blue dress with white piping.
No, it was black.
A black.
Black. Ruffles.
Uh-huh.
Ruffles. Several rows.
That must have been.
He also bought me a white dress off the shoulder.
Uh-huh.
Just one little strap on the other side.
Uh-huh.
And off his right shoulder. He was very nice.
He had good taste, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
He was, you know, being an artist, I wasn't aware that he was as important a designer of watches and stuff.
Yes.
He's got quite a reputation.
He designed a... it wasn't a Boulevard, an Elgin watch for me.
Uh-huh.
It was real nice.
Yeah, he said you never wore it.
I did wear it.
You did? Because he said you were always late, you know. If you could count on anything, it was Betty not being there on time. Do you know, why was that, Betty Page? Do you know? Do you have any theory about...
I don't know. Took me so long to get ready, I guess.
They say you were constantly brushing your hair. But I can't, you know, you're a model. You have to look good. I can't see that as a complaint. What, do you remember what restaurants you used to like to eat at in that neighborhood?
Well, there was a Spanish place that was all decorated inside like a South Sea island.
Uh-huh.
Waterfalls and everything.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of it, but it had delicious food. I used to like to eat there once in a while.
Uh-huh. Why did you ever try to get into radio?
No, I never tried it.
It seemed by the time you got to New York City that radio was about dead. You know, the TV was the new coming thing. Do you remember bumping into any stars, any, you know, big TV stars in the 50s in New York City?
Well, I met one agent who was an agent for Rory Calhoun.
Uh-huh.
And Rory Calhoun and his wife, Lita Baron, were appearing at a theater over in New Jersey. he was playing in the Sundowners, and during the stage show, he used a lariat, a rope, and did a lot of tricks with it. And when the show came on, he came back and sat down by me, and he was holding my hand throughout the rest of the show.
Very charming.
With his wife right on the other side of him.
No.
I felt real strange. And I met Wendell Corey and Steve Lawrence at a luncheon upstairs in the restaurant. I met both of them.
How did you meet Earl Wilson? How did that come to be?
I don't know how I met him.
Uh-huh.
Irving Claw told him that I was had been voted Pennant Girl of the World for 1955. And he put me on his show, on his TV show, with that title.
Right.
But other than that, I don't know when I met him.
That got you a lot of good press, that title.
Yes, I think so.
You know, that was very good. I've seen several pieces with your name associated with that. Now, Tal, let's square this all away. I've seen your physical proportions listed about 8 different ways. The men's magazines didn't seem to care what the truth was, and they would create, you know, whatever.
I know.
What was your average height during the 50s?
5'8", 5.5".
5'8"?
5 feet, 5.5".
Oh, 5'5". That was about what
That's
I guessed.
That's my regular height without heels.
Right. And your weight during that period was about?
I hovered around 128 to 130.
Great. And this may seem like a strange question, but every time I see a color picture of you, your eyes are a different color. So, I give up. What color are your eyes?
Blue-gray.
Because sometimes they look, you know, more green, so it's very...
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot to do, I guess, with the printing, too.
I guess so.
Okay. Here's another question. Were you on the top floor of your apartment building?
There is no top floor. It's just a...
You were on the last floor that, on 46th Street.
Oh, you mean New York?
Yeah, New York on 46th Street.
Yes, it was the fourth floor, and that was the top floor.
Uh-huh. Did you used to open up the roof hatch, to get a ventilation going?
No.
Because I've got a studio on 45th Street that I thought must be an awful lot like your old building must have looked.
My living room apparently was an artist's studio at one time or other.
Uh-huh.
It had a little platform in front of the window.
Uh-huh.
A little, like an artist's little platform that he would use.
Uh-huh.
And the only windows in the apartment were right in front of the platform.
Right.
So where the light would come in.
And that faced the back of the building. Did you ever photograph at your apartment? Did you ever let anybody shoot up there?
No. Because nobody ever came up there except actors when I started studying acting.
Uh-huh. You would run through...
We had to do scenes on
scenes.
Monday nights.
Right.
And all during the week we would prepare for it.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes whoever I was doing a scene with would come up there and we would rehearse.
Right. So it was mostly for your acting. Do you ever have any pets up there? Cats or fish or?
Yes, I had some fish, some guppies and goldfish and other little kitties.
But no fur-bearing animals that you that you'd have to take care of. Yeah. Did you ever regret getting into modeling? Was there a time you were sorry?
No, I never regretted it.
Uh-huh.
I enjoyed doing it.
Right. So, you remember shooting the movie Teaserama with Irving up at the Claw Studios?
I remember making a couple of those things at Irving Claw's.
Because I remember you were in an Egyptian, you know, veils and silk pants and very Egyptian looking thing, and you did some kind of a dance of veils. I can't wait to see it. they just found the two movies. They finally found Teaserama and Stripperama. Those movies were lost. They were lost for 20 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, nobody's ever seen you in color dancing. But you did this thing where you got in and took a bath in a big black bathtub.
I remember that.
Now, lost to history. What about a guy named John Willie, an Australian?
I don't remember him either.
Who did, I think, bondage stuff for Claw. Also, I talked to Paula Claw, who sends her best wishes and her love, and she remembers that the guy that introduced you to the Claws was a Jewish guy. He was married to one of the models. And what was the other fact? Does that ring any notes for you?
No.
Still don't remember who introduced you to the Claws?
No, I don't.
Boy, that's frustrating. Because that's one of your, you know, most important relationships.
Yeah.
I think Claw, of all people, was most responsible for bringing you to a large portion of the public's eye. What did you think of Claw? What was your, you know, impression of Irving?
I liked him all right. He just seemed to me like a man who was very busy with his work and that he enjoyed what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
And he was always nice to the girls.
Right. Did you guys frequently go out after the shoots?
No.
Uh-huh.
We never went out.
Okay. Were you generally happy with the way your photographs were presented?
Yes, I enjoyed looking at them if they were good and criticizing them if they weren't.
Did you learn from them? You know, did you say, oh, I'll never do that one again, that doesn't look good?
Yes.
That's what I thought, you know, because I look at your earliest Irving Claw photographs, and you know, it's a little bit gawky and a little unpolished, and very, very quickly you get the hang of it, and you're beautiful. Did you study your photographs when Claw was making them?
Yes, some of them. I didn't see a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a few. He never sent the model any pictures.
Right. But I mean, I imagine if you were there at the store, you could go over and look at your own shots. Do you remember your first bondage shoot for Claw?
No.
Because, I mean, that one would seem kind of unusual, you know. How did you respond to that? What was your thought about
it? I just thought it was fun.
Just acting?
We laugh and have a good time putting on some of the crazy outfits.
No kidding.
Some men would send us to have us put on.
And that crazy harness thing that holy man.
The pony harness.
Yeah. Some of the get-ups that they put, was it ever uncomfortable?
No.
It was always...
The only problem was those 6-inch high heel shoes that he had us wear.
Uh-huh.
There was just one pair that I could walk in.
Uh-huh.
And all, if you noticed, all of the pictures of the bondage and nearly everything else for Irving Claw that I did, I was wearing that one pair of shoes.
Oh, your lucky shoes, so to speak.
I couldn't even move around in some of those other heels.
Uh-huh. Did he mostly provide the get-ups, the costumes, or did you bring some of your own stuff in?
I brought some of my own in, and some of them were his.
Uh-huh. I remember this one, it looks like a chorus girl outfit. It's kind of cut low in the front, and spangles, and it's dark. It seems to me it's like got some fur around the top. I mean, some really beautiful, ornate stuff. You made most of your costumes?
Yes, I made a great number of them. I enjoyed seeing what I could rig up.
Yeah. Did you resew your, you know, did you go out and buy stuff from stores and then come and resew it?
No, I never did that. Well, I did buy some from Fredericks of Hollywood.
Huh.
But I had to fit them to me, so I had to sew on them after all.
Right. do you remember what, just out of curiosity, do you remember what it is you ordered from Frederick's?
No.
So long ago? Yeah. Uh-huh. Do you remember doing a cigarette commercial in Florida? Yeah, Dick Arbib was telling me about, you guys went down to Miami.
Yeah.
Somebody saw you and they filmed it right on the street. He said he watched you, and he says, bet he didn't even smoke, and there she was doing a cigarette commercial, sitting in a car. Does that sound familiar?
No, it doesn't.
Uh-oh.
A lot of things I don't remember about the past.
Boy, that must go way, way back, 53 or 4, when you guys went down there.
Yeah.
What do you remember about shooting in Africa, USA? Remember with Bunny Yeager at that theme park?
It was very nice, but I hadn't had any sleep the night before, so I looked terrible. I looked like I had been on a big drunk or something.
I don't think so. I think those are some of your best photos ever. I really like that shoot, especially with the cats. How were the cats to work with?
Well, they were out of sorts that morning, and the manager didn't want me to pose with them. He thought they might get bombed or something. They were supposed to have been not feeling good that day.
Yeah.
But they didn't bother me. I had a fine time with them.
And a chimpanzee?
No, I don't remember.
Yeah, and a donkey? A little burro? Seems to me there's a shot of you sitting on it. Riding a burro.
Yes.
In your Jungle Girl outfit. Did you make that outfit?
Yes. I had just finished it at 1:30 in the morning the night before she was to come and get me. And that's when I had that big black fella in my window taken off the screen, and I got scared. And I sat in the back of my landlady's house and a little screened-in porch until daylight.
Oh, somebody tried to break into your place.
Yeah.
What an amazing story. It's funny because really it's one of the best photo shoots that you ever did. You look beautiful in it.
I felt terrible. I hadn't had a wink of sleep all night.
Amazing. You would never know it. Did you ever meet Hugh Hefner? Did you ever meet with him personally face to face? Because he had a big crush on you. You were a big favorite of his. So much so that his girlfriend, the woman eventually, I guess he married, Barbie Benton, has a striking resemblance to you. I can't help but think that that's somehow a little bit of wish fulfillment.
Might have been.
You know, that he had his own, if he couldn't have the real Betty Page, that he'd have to settle for somebody who looked like you. I guess that's the ultimate flattery. Do you remember anything about a photographer by the name of Hanau, a Florida photographer?
Yes, I remember him. He took a lot of pictures of me for postcards.
Yes, they're everywhere. They still make those.
But the lighting was very bad on my face in some of the pictures. I looked like I had a big gap between my teeth. So I wasn't too fond of his pictures.
He didn't shoot you too much, did he? Okay. What about Gay Talese? Now, back around 1977, Bunny tried to contact you through a newspaper ad, I think it was.
He wanted to do another book on me.
Uh-huh.
An up-to-date book.
Right.
And I wasn't interested in doing it.
Right.
I was married to Harry and taking care of the history children.
Right.
And I didn't think I'd be able to get into all of that or doing another book on me.
Uh-huh. Now, somebody told me that you visited a bookstore in Los Angeles and bought two copies of the Playboy that you were in to give to your kids.
No.
Doesn't sound like you?
No.
Somebody said, oh my God, this woman came in here and she said, let me see that issue, and I said, it's too much money, you wouldn't want it, and we opened it up, and the woman said, that's me. Doesn't sound familiar?
No.
Okay, I'll buy that. Also, somebody told me that you actually met Kiefhoffer.
Yeah.
But I remember you saying that you waited.
No, I didn't mean it.
No, because somebody gave that famous quote, Senator, honey, I think they're cute. I wonder where in the world that comes from. Why did you quit working at Movie Star News?
Why did I quit working where?
For Irvin Clark, Movie Star News.
Well, I quit working for him just before I left New York in December 1957.
See, because I always thought that it had something to do with the Kieffer stuff and the bondage material, and you thought, well, you know, if Irvin Claw is going to be constantly hounded by the FBI, I better not be here.
No, I didn't feel like that at all.
Uh-huh.
I just didn't like the way they treated me in the courthouse that day.
Right.
Half a night and day. I didn't like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't bother me that they were hounding Irvin Claw.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he seemed to be pretty impervious to... they kept trying to arrest him and send him up, and it just never would stick.
Well, he didn't do enough or anything wrong.
True.
To happen.
True. His photographs are cute. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. Somebody said that they saw you in near King's Port, Kingston, Kingsport.
In that article that Karen Essex wrote about me in the L.A. Weekly.
Yeah.
She said that I was born in Kingsport.
Right.
I've never been to Kingsport, Tennessee.
Oh, you've never been there?
No.
Because somebody said that they saw you at a place on one of the main roads called Pat's Diner. That you used to eat at a place called Pat's Diner around 1963 or 4?
No.
Doesn't sound familiar?
No, I don't remember in the Pat's Diner. Where was it supposed to be?
On a main road near Kingsport, coming out of it. Coming towards Nashville.
No.
Apparently there's a big school near there to a college.
In Kingsport, Tennessee?
Yeah. Or maybe it was a high school. The guy didn't clarify that with me. But you'd be amazed at all of the, you know, people saw you, you know, as a waitress in Texas. And somebody saw you giving out literature at the Chicago O'Hare Airport.
No, not at the airport. When I was going to Moody Bible Institute in Chicago,
right.
I used to give out leaflets.
Do you remember where in Chicago you were doing that?
Just near LaSalle Street.
Uh-huh.
Between the Lincoln Park and...
the downtown area.
Downtown.
Uh-huh. Did you enjoy that? Was that a nice time of your life?
Yes, I enjoyed it very much. I was happier during those 3 years that I was going to Bible school than I have ever been.
Hmm. Did you have a lot of friends in Chicago, or were you pretty much still a loner?
No, I was pretty much a loner. I had one young friend, a fellow named Bob. We would go witnessing together, but he was the only real friend I had.
So even though you were, you know, pretty much alone during your 3 years of Bible schools, you were still happy?
Yes.
Do you consider yourself a loner? Is that the way you would describe yourself?
Not all the time.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time by myself.
Uh-huh.
I've spent a lot of time sewing. Be very happy sewing. Sewing and listening to the radio.
Uh-huh. And, what do you like to hear on the radio?
Oh, I used to hear all of the good programs.
Yeah. Music or... religious program, dramatic shows, yeah.
Little Theater off Times Square was my favorite program.
Oh, yeah.
And The Shadow was next.
You wouldn't miss him, huh? You know, somebody once told me that they saw you walking in Times Square, it's about 1968, with a guy that looked like Steve Reeves.
1968.
Something like that, yeah.
It was probably Harry McCabe.
You know, I thought that might be the case. Was he a big, strapping, handsome guy?
Yeah, he's not too big, though.
Yeah? Because an artist friend of mine said he swore to God that it was Steve Reeves and you in 1968 in Times Square.
We took a trip, Harry and his three children, and I. We went all up through New England.
Uh-huh.
We went to Radio City Music Hall. It was 68 or 69.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 69 because in 1968 we came to California.
Uh-huh.
We went to Disneyland and up to the Muir Woods and Grand Canyon and
uh-huh.
all those places. It was a real funny musical with Jack Lemmon.
Well, that's a good clue.
The Out of Towners.
Oh, well, that would be the
town,
that would be the perfect one to see with you guys coming from out of town. It was kind of a nightmare movie about New York, though.
Yes.
So, also, I wanted to know about England. Somebody told me that you had been spotted in England. There was a photograph run of you in England. Did you ever get there?
No.
No travel outside?
The only place out of the country I've been is Canada and New Mexico, a little over the border in New Mexico.
Right. Was that when you were in California?
That was in 1968.
Oh, when you were traveling the country.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Rocketeer comic book?
No, I haven't.
Would you like me to send you a copy of that?
Yes, I would like to have one.
If your brother would ever forward my stuff, you know, you'd...
Did you send me a copy of one of the Betty Pages?
I sent you two of them.
They never arrived either.
8 and 7, I think it was, and another check. And I've kind of forgotten what else, but...
How long ago did you send them to Jack?
Oh, it was at least a month. At least a month. And it was a long... As soon as I got back from the holidays, seems to me I sent it right out.
I don't know where in the world they are.
Yeah, well, I'll have to call him and,
Well, he'll probably be calling me in a couple of days or so.
Yeah.
And I'll ask him what has he done with them.
Dave is obviously a very big fan of yours. Did you see that little sculpture that they did of you? There's Dave Stevens and Graffiti Enterprises did a little cold cast sculpture of you.
No.
Sitting on a, you know, a little stand with a drape over it.
Mm.
It's very cute. In fact, the latest issue of the Betty Pages has a complete list of all of the appearances and photos and features that have been done on you. So as soon as he sends that to you, you'll see all of these goodies that have been, you know, these products made up about Betty Page. It's quite remarkable. What do you think about all this?
I just think it's very strange that after all these years that I'm popular again. I think it's very unusual.
It really is, because, again, I can't think of anybody who this has ever happened to before. It's very peculiar. You know, it's like, because so little has been known about you, all that there was rumors. Somebody said that you were, you married Lash LaRue's cousin or Lash LaRue's brother or...
No.
It's another one of those crazy rumors.
There was a rumor around that I had lived in the trailer, that I was living in the trailer park, but I've never lived in the trailer park.
Ever. Uh-huh. So it's fun, you know, those little pieces dribbled and drabbled back to me. I never really knew what was truth or wasn't. Now,
the wildest one is that one of that I was married to a sheik.
Yeah, well,
I don't know where that came.
I wasn't inclined to believe that one. I didn't think it too likely. But somebody said that you were living at a convent or in a convent in Los Angeles.
No. I went to the Bible Institute in Los Angeles for a year, but not in any convent.
Mm-hmm. So it was my impression that you were supposed to be living behind a church in a motel area designed for young women.
No. somebody wants to use the phone.
All right, Betty. As much as I love talking to you, I'll let you go. It's always fun talking to you, right? You know, it answers these questions that have been dogging me for a long time.
Oh, okay.
All right, Betty, you take care of yourself, and I'll talk to you again soon.
You too.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Ah, there you go, Seekers. Greg Theakson was a crazy bastard to work for, but you've got to admit he did one hell of an interview here. Betty Page in her own words from 1996, and she cut it off right there because he was getting way too close to the actual truth. And what was the actual truth, Seekers? Well, you're going to have to wait until next week to find that out. When we plumb the mysteries that we are going to find on side two of this remarkable audio cassette. So until then, sleep tight, Seekers. Good night.